pastor, Father Ed White. The first time I met him, he was not a pastor. He was a person involved in war. It was, I guess, 10 or 12 years ago that I came to Seattle, and I had dinner here in Seattle with Matt Ulrich and Ed White, who was a lawyer. And he started the Helpers of God's Precious Infants here in Seattle. And after a number of years, he decided he wouldn't want to be a lawyer any longer. He began to study for the priesthood. And he is now your pastor. And he asked me to come and to speak to you. You see this scarf? This is from Sydney, Australia. They had recently a World Youth Day. Yeah, are you acquainted with World Youth Day? Okay, yes. What is today? Today is World Youth Day for the United States. And the World Youth Day is something that has resulted in what we call the JP2 generation. And JP2 generation is young people throughout the world who are affected by Pope John Paul II. I'm involved in life and trying to establish the respect for life. And I was in Omaha, Nebraska, and I'm speaking to a group of people, and after I finished, a young fellow came up to me. He's about 27, 28 years old, and he said, Monsignor, you don't have to worry about us. Father White, well, God bless you.
Welcome to
my parents. Great. Glad to be here.
I haven't seen him since my first Mass there. Good to see you.
I preached his first Mass. I was in Omaha, Nebraska, and this young fellow comes up to me and he said, Monsignor, you don't have to worry about us. Now, it was 36 years ago, there was a Supreme Court decision on January 22nd. What was that decision? Does anyone know? It was Roe v. Wade, which they legalized abortion in the United States for 9 months. Did you know that? You can kill a child all the way through to 9 months in the womb. And they felt that as the people who were opposed to it grew old, they would have the rest. The young people would be brainwashed into accepting it as a way of life. And the young father came up to me and he said, Father, you don't have to worry about us. At that point, he was 28 years old, 27 years old. And he said, anyone who was born after that decision, the great majority of those young people are for life. I said, why? He said, because a light bulb eventually goes off. And you begin to realize that in a classroom, one out of every three of our classmates is missing. They are not there. You begin to realize when I was in the womb of my mother, this court said, you could kill me for no reason at all. And so once that begins to sink in, how do you respect the court that said that they could kill me? How do you respect the court that has one out of every three of my classmates an empty desk? And that's a fact. One out of every three has been killed. I come from an area called New York City where the African Americans are being wiped off the face of the earth throughout this country, in particular I come from. In Kings County, in New York City, out of every 100 black unborn children, 70 are aborted. That's beyond comprehension. And our Holy Father knew that the next generation he had to reach out to. And I tell you, the first World Youth Day actually took place on October 4th, 1979. And it took place in New York City. A Holy Father came to New York to speak to the United Nations and speak to others. But he then said to the bishops, he said, I'd like to speak to young people. To young people. And there was nothing on the program for them. He said, make it. And so they hired what was called Madison Square Garden. It's a great athletic boxing. It's a place in New York City that everybody knows because of the types of basketball and so forth that takes place. Well, they rented Madison Square Garden, and suddenly it was 25,000 young people waiting for the Pope. And on it, it had a youth concert with JP II, John Paul II. And I remember when he came. He came in that Pope mobile that they has, you know, that they ride in, and he came in, and there were 25,000 young people that were just waiting to hear what he would say. But he was very playful. Every time you thought he was going to speak, he didn't. And actually started singing songs that he knew in his youth in Polish. And behind him were all the cardinals and bishops, so proper. And he was sitting, they were all standing, and every time he went to talk, and the kids wanted to talk, he didn't talk. He played games with them. And I remember at one point, Cardinal Cook, he was the Cardinal Archbishop of New York at the time, he came to the Holy Father, and he took his watch, and he said, like this, the schedule, see? And then the Holy Father bent over and leaned towards the young people as though the bishops and cardinals could not hear him. He puts his hands on his face, he looks like this out at the young people, and he says, they tell me I'm breaking the schedule, see? And the poor bishops and Cardinal Cook, they all turned so red because he was playing games. But then finally, he just kept waiting. And back and forth. And finally, before he talked, you could hear a pin drop. And then when he did speak, he only spoke of Christ. In other words, he was an incredible player. He drew people to himself, but when he finally would speak, he would not speak about himself. He spoke about Jesus Christ. And so what he said, when you wonder about the mystery of life, look to Christ. When you wonder about the mystery in your life of suffering, look to Christ. And for each thing, he said, look to Christ. Any one of those young people, remember that like it was yesterday. And it was from that began the World Youth Days. Eventually, instead of trying to fit young people in when he came to a visit, he decided, I would have a day just for young people. In fact, we'll have it a week. And I was at a number of these World Youth Days. The one we just had, they gave this to me in Sydney, Australia. I remember I was in Dusseldorf. There was a World Youth Day in Köln in Germany. And again, it's providential, isn't it? Interesting, but our late Pope John Paul II, before he died, he picked out the city for the next World Youth Day. He picked out Köln in Germany. And in the providence of God, it was a German Pope. He set it up for him. But in Europe, they said, the young people will not come. So godless. They will not come. They will not come to listen to an old man, 80 years old. Well, I was there. And they did come. And there was more than 1 million young people at that World Youth Day meeting. And while we were there, we did a prayer vigil for life with the young people in Düsseldorf. And these young people, it was incredible. I remember when we went, we had these huge motorcycle, large German police officers who accompanied us, and we walked and we played all through Düsseldorf. And in the beginning, the young people were sort of a little bit timid, and we were leading it. We had the helpers throughout the world. So the helpers in Germany organized this, but there was the helpers there from Switzerland, from France, from the United Kingdom, various parts of the world. And we were leading the vigil, these young people, through the streets. Where were we going? We were going to a modern-day Golgotha, to Calvary, where innocent blood is being shed, where their youngest brothers and sisters are being destroyed. And they were going to defend them, to rescue them. And remember we went, and we did the rosary as we prayed through the streets and sang songs. We did the rosary in 6 or 7 languages. And every time the French students came to French, they would sing the Hail Mary. And they had three or four different ways and rhythms to sing the Hail Mary. It's magnificent. And so we said the Hail Mary in French, in Spanish, in German, you see? And we went to, and we got to the site. The ones who were running this clinic, largest abortion clinic in Dusseldorf, they were shocked. Because all these young people were on their knees outside the front doors. The whole place came out. And these young people were singing and praising God. And suddenly, there's a tremendous witness for life through the whole of the city. And coming back, it was interesting. They were so enthused, instead of us leading them back, they took over. And I couldn't stay with them. And they were walking so fast, and they were so filled with life, because what we do is we start with the Mass, we expose the Blessed Sacrament to the end, and then we go out with Mary leading us in the way, and we go to Golgotha, to Calvary, innocent blood is being shed today, and then we go back for the blessing, the benediction of the Lord. And going back, I couldn't stay with them. I thought I got cramp in my leg. They were walking so fast. They were filled with joy. They had done something great for God. I just came from Sacramento, California. And we just had a prayer vigil. And we went to Planned Parenthood. And the same thing. It keeps on happening all over the world. And it was interesting. You know, I went to Kiev, Ukraine. I was coming down from the Baltic Sea, Riga, Latvia, and I landed there, and there was two doctors that were, two women doctors, who were going to start to help us in Ukraine, where they suffered greatly. And I'll tell you a story which is true. There was a great doctor for life from Croatia, Dr. Anton Lisek. And he spoke Russian and English. He was going to meet me at the airport. And we were going to bring this whole approach to the Ukraine. And he met me, and these doctors brought us to a place to stay for the night. But the church in Eastern Europe is poor. Under the communists, all their properties were taken. All the churches were taken. And when they gave it back most recently, they gave it to the Orthodox Church. But the Orthodox Church has not yet given over the properties, in many cases, to the Catholic Church. And so they are living poor. And they took me to a place to stay for the night. It was outside the city. And it was to a monastery that actually was run by missionaries, or it was Carmelites from Poland were on a missionary journey, and they opened up this monastery. And I get there, and this Father John comes out, and he can't speak that much English, and I don't know that much Russian. So we had a little bit of difficulty. But it looked like, well, it's not exactly the Hotel Hilton, but it'll have to do for the night. So I was about to go inside, and he says to me, "Well, no, we have no room." I said, "You have no room? Where?" He says, "Over there, over there." So myself and Dudley said, "Over there, it looks like an outhouse. What are you talking about? That's where you go." See? So we had to go across this, it was water with stones, okay? And as I was just coming here from your place, you see, I was thinking of Ukraine. See, I was going, walking on the stones, it was raining, that's what it was. And I got there, and as he's opening up the door, this Polish oblate says, "Problema, problema." I said, "Problema, problema, yeah, problem, problem." I said, "What's the problem?" He said, "Aqua, aqua. You know, aqua, water, water." I said, "Water? No water?" I said, "In the showers? No water showers." I said, "In the sink? No water in the sink." I said, "In the toilet? No water in the toilet." I said, "We got a problem." "We have a problem." He said, but, he says, "You can come over to the main house and take a shower, fix yourself up." I said, "Well, it's not too bad, but we have a problem." I said, "What's the problem?" He said, "We have thieves. They steal. At 9 o'clock, we lock everything down. We don't open it up to 7 o'clock the next morning. So whatever you have to do, you have to do it before 9 o'clock at night and wait until 7 o'clock the next morning. As an older man, that's a long wait. For you, maybe no problem. For me, this is a problem." See? This is a problem. It was true. That's what he did. He locked us out. And I'm over with, in the house there with Dr. Anton Lisek, and there's no lights. Never mind water. I couldn't find lights. There's an old house. And between the first floor and the second floor, the stairs wasn't exactly a stairs. You had to get a ladder and rest it and go up this like one rung ladder to get to the second floor. And Dr. Lisek is babbling on about we must sacrifice to these people. I said, sacrifice is absurd. This is absurd. So he says, wait, I found a bucket. He found a bucket, see? And with the bucket, he says, I'm going to go out and get water. And we're going to get water. I will find water, he says. So he goes out and he finds a pond, a polluted pond. And he comes back with a bucket of polluted water. He said, well, at least this will take care of the bathroom. This will take care of the bathroom. And I get upstairs, and we can't find the lights. And the beds are not beds. They're double bucket beds, you know, like you find in the camps where you just get in. And I am in this upper bunk in darkness without water. Not now, what am I doing here in Ukraine, you see? And then I thought to myself, wait a second. Tomorrow will be a great day, because I know how God works. He reduces you to nothing, and then he takes over. You see? Because if you think you're going to do it, watch out. Okay? You're going to fall on your face. The next day was incredible. Incredible. The next day I met with the Apostolic Nuncio of Ukraine for 2 hours. I had no previous appointment. After 2 hours, he wanted me to speak to all the bishops in Ukraine. And we met with each one. We started to help us. As a matter of fact, those two doctors that started there, they came to a World Conference for Life that we ran in Vienna, Austria. And they wanted to do the same thing in Ukraine, which they did. And 2 years later, they had taken the largest assembly hall under the communists and used it for a conference for life, inviting all the key people, even the apostolic nuncios, the head of the congregation of family and life from Rome, the government officials, everyone. 2,000 people came to that conference. And I think back, the bucket of water, darkness, you see, how things go. And I was invited to come to speak. Well, this time, I was going to the Hotel Moscow. Never mind, Brother John, okay? I'm at the Hotel Moscow. I had a room. It's right near the thing. I justified myself. It's right near the assembly hall, conference hall. I have to speak. It'd be a... I get there, and I'm out there 10 minutes, and I'm thrown out. They didn't have enough room. I said, you're kidding me. I'm out again? So what I found a sheet of paper. It was very impressive. It looked to me like it was the Archbishop's residence or something. It was all in Russian, though, so I didn't know. So I said to him, would you call this place and see if they have a room for me for the night? And he called. And he got some priest. And the priest said, yes, let him come. We have a room for him. So I got in this cab. The man only spoke Russian. Okay? I was only speaking English. But all my luggage. And he starts to drive me. This is the address. Drive me to this address. To this address. He did. We started to go. And we kept going. And I said, you're going pretty far. Where is the residence here? Well, this is what you told me to go. I'm going. And finally, I almost starts to leave the city. I started to go to blocks that I have seen before. And oh no. He keeps driving, and he pulls up in front of the monastery run by Father John from Poland. You see? And as can't be. Okay? And he comes out. And I said, Father John, is this your letterhead? He said, yes, isn't that very good? Isn't that very good? I did it. I said, oh, you did. I looked at the place and I said, there, no. I said, I know, over there. And I'm going across the stubble and I'm back in the same bunk bed that I was there 2 years ago, still without lights and water, you see. And I'm lying there, now I even have Dr. Anton Lisek to give me some compassion. I'm there by myself. And I'm there. And then suddenly, the bell goes off again, the light goes on, tomorrow will be a great day. And it was. It was. It was incredible. It was a great day for life, okay? So one of the things I wanted to stress to you is this, is that sometimes God has to reduce you to nothing to show it's His power. My grace is sufficient for you. Understand that? Don't complain. It's the best thing. And there was another thing. I was in Christchurch, New Zealand. You know New Zealand? It's sort of south of Australia. Right? And I was in Christchurch, New Zealand. And I had gone through this North Island down to the South Island. I'm in Christchurch. One thing I found, Christchurch is named a city. Yeah, it's a major city in New Zealand. And it was time for me to go to Melbourne, Australia. So I go, and I go to check out, and I'm there. This late person brought me to the airport, brought me down, and about to check in. Everything's fine. And the last thing he asked me is my passport. I give him my passport. They said, where's your visa? I said, visa? What do I need a visa for? When I get there, I just have Mark. I'm going to be there for a couple of weeks. Oh, no. This is one of the countries, back then, you need a visa beforehand in order to come in. I said, where do you get the visa? Where in the airport? Not here. You got to go to the Australian embassy. I said, and where is the Australian embassy? They said, it's in Auckland, New Zealand. Auckland, you mean the place where I just flew down from for 3 hours in a plane is where I have to go back to get into Melbourne? They said, well, yes. But there is one other Australian embassy. It's in Wellington, which is still the North Island. You'd have to take a plane to get there. And the poor man was with me, a layman, Pete. He said, Father, I'm so sorry, they didn't tell you. I know what to do. I have to go home to my wife and children. My wife and children, see? He said, I have a name here. It's Father Peter. And Father Peter, he says, I only have this address. I don't know more about it. Go, and when you get there, go and ask him for a bed for the night. So I said, what else can I do? So I checked to see if there was a flight from Wellington to Melbourne the next day. There was, and there was one seat left on it. And I immediately pulled out my credit card and booked it, because there was only one seat left. Now, I was supposed to speak with an auxiliary bishop in Melbourne that next night. His name was George Pell. Bishop Pell. He's now the Archbishop Cardinal of Sydney, Australia, whom I just met at the Revue Day. Well, it ended up that I said goodbye to the fella. I went to Melbourne. I went to Wellington. Got off the plane. It was midnight. And I went. I said to the cab driver, take me to the site. He did. I got there and took all the luggage I started. But I saw nothing there. There was nothing. There was no church, no school, no nothing. What did he give me? And the fella said, that's not my problem. I brought you to where you wanted to go. And this is where I got to go home to my wife and family. It's the same thing. Your wife and family. Oh, blessed celibacy. My wife and family, see? And he dumped everything on the sidewalk. He dumped everything on the sidewalk. And he told me that he has to leave. And he did. And I'm standing at midnight in Wellington with the luggage around me saying to God, what are you doing now? What are you doing now? And the moon was shining, and I went over to the wall, and on the wall there was a plaque. I'm looking at the plaque, and it says, Cardinal's Residence. I said, Cardinal's Residence? What did he give me? I go back, and I look at it, the big house, and then there's a bell there, and I said, I need a bed. So I'm going to ring that bell. I rang the bell, and who answers the door but Cardinal Williams, the head primate bishop of all New Zealand. And I'm standing outside midnight. He opens the door, he says, what do you want? I said, I need a bed. He said, you what? I said, I want a bed. You want a bed? I said, I came a long way for this bed. He said, where did you come from? I said, Brooklyn, New York. Well, the man was so shocked with the reality of it that he ended up, that he said, come in. I came in, and I had lunch with him, talked about the helpers. He brought over the pro-life director, and we now have the helpers' prayer vigils in Wellington every month since then. I went to the Australian embassy. I got the embassy, the thing marked down. You see my visa? Came back, and Father Peter was bringing me to the airport at 3 o'clock to get to the flight because the people were waiting for me in Melbourne. When I was in Christchurch, I called, I knew the people waiting for me in Melbourne. I didn't know who they were. So I called Sydney, Australia, and I said, Sydney, will you do me a favor? I said, yes. I said, will you tell the people in Melbourne I'm not coming? I said, okay, who are they? I said, I haven't got a clue. Just tell them I'm not coming. So the next day, they're waiting for me now in Melbourne again. And I now have my visa. And I'm waiting for them to ask for my passport. I give my luggage and I say, may I have your passport? I said, yes, you may. And there is the visa. And she says, wonderful, wonderful, no problem. And suddenly a man comes out from behind her, taps her on the shoulder. She turns back to me with this long, sad face. I said, what's the problem? She said, Father, I know how to tell you this. We overbooked. You have been bumped. You can't get on this plane. I said, I can't get, when's the next plane? There is no other plane today. I said, you're kidding me. They're waiting for me in Melbourne. Oh my God, I have to call Sydney. So I called Sydney and I said, will you tell the people waiting for me in Melbourne I'm not coming? They said, sure, Father, who are they? I don't know, but tell them I'm not coming again. And so I said, what do I do? So I went and I brought my luggage out and I got a cab. I went back to the Cardinal's residence. And I rang the bell. With my luck, who answered the door but Cardinal Williams? And he says, what are you doing here again? I said, I need a bed. And he said, I can't see you today. I said, why not? He said, because, don't you, all the bishops of New Zealand are meeting at my place today for a special meeting. I said, all the bishops of New Zealand are meeting here today? He said, yes, now I know why I am back. And we actually had the bishops in every major city in New Zealand and Australia leading God's Help Us prayer vigils. See? And the lesson in that is, God will change your schedule. Don't fight God's will. Do what you have to do, but don't oppose God's will. Let Him do it His way. So that the reality is that I encourage you to become involved in life. The Father does that. In the helpers of God's precious infants. To give a public witness for life, you see? Because this is important. Your youngest brothers and sisters actually depend upon you for their existence. Their lives are being taken. And if you do not help them, who will? And eventually history will make a judgment call on us. See? What did you do during the time of the humane Holocaust? Humane. It's so nice. So when I was in Dachau visiting, I tried to tell the sisters, actually Carmelite sisters, in the Precious Blood Convent, to pray that people's eyes would be open, that the death camps, the death chambers, are all over the world, and they're not far from where anyone lives. Not far from anyone lives these days, you see. And that would you open up the eyes, they don't have to come here to have the refrain given them again and again, never again, never again. I say to you, it's again and again and again, and it's not far from where you live. And what are you doing about it? Now, I'd like to just close just telling you this. When I go around the world, people ask me, once they find out from New York City, where was I at 9/11? When the Twin Towers came down. Well, the truth of the matter is this. At 9:10, 11 o'clock at night, I was at the Twin Towers. I was at the Twin Towers with a woman, doctor from Romania. Her husband and another doctor from Romania had been at the monastery learning how to take the helpers approach back to Romania, which they did, and I had gone there. But she wanted to see one last time the great accomplishments of man, these two incredible huge buildings, all buildings around them. And we had that up in the observation deck that week, and we took video. Her husband, one of the men, the engineer, took videos inside. We have the last pictures inside of the observatory observation deck of the United of those towers, that is fact, because it came down right after that. Now we came back the next day, and I counsel, do sidewalk counseling outside an abortion clinic at the foot of New York Harbor. You look across the harbor and you see the two Twin Towers, see? And while we were there that morning, and this doctor came with me. And she came with me, and when she did, she was counseling, the Twin Towers came down. And when they came down, the wind was blowing our direction. We went right across the harbor to Brooklyn. And suddenly, at midday, the whole sky was actually black. And everything was falling out of, the debris was falling down on top of us. And another priest was there. His name was Father Delendick. He was a chaplain to the New York City Fire Department. And there was a Father Judge. There was two chaplains. Father Judge died. People do not know that Father Delendick almost died. He had to leave me. He had to leave to go because to Ground Zero. I could not leave. Do you know why I could not leave? Everything stopped in New York when those Twin Towers came down. There was not absolutely necessary to be done. Except for one thing. They continue the killing of the unborn children all over the city through that period of time. And I could not leave because the reality is they still killed the children, and I could not leave until that was finished. But I did get to Ground Zero at midnight. And when I got there, it was incredible. There were volunteers, the fire, we had to put masks on our face to breathe. You couldn't breathe. The smell was unbelievable. And the very brave people going in trying still to save lives. I'll tell you a little thing you might not have read in the papers. Father Delendick was the chaplain to the New York City Fire Department. And when those firemen were there and they saw those Twin Towers burning, they turned around to Father Delendick and they said, "Father, this is worse than Normandy, the invasion of Normandy." They looked at those Twin Towers and they said to him, "You know, we are not coming back." Interesting. Ordinary men. "We're not coming back." And they said, "Father, isn't the condition present for general absolution?" And he said, "You're right." And those brave men took off their helmets and they knelt down and bowed their head and they asked for God's mercy. And Father absolved them. And they stood up and they put on their helmets and they went running into a burning building. When they got inside, the elevators, which you don't use during the time of fire, so the firemen could use them, they were not working. With all the heavy equipment, they had to start making their way up to the 80th floor. And on each floor they were running up, they were getting the people out. And it's an incredible contrast of people running for their lives down and those brave firemen getting them out on each floor, out. They saved 25 to 30,000 people that day. They did, in fact. And they kept running up, and they did not make it to the 80th floor. It came down. And in 3 minutes, 350 firemen lost their lives. And they did it knowingly, giving their lives, trying to rescue others. And all of a sudden, who was a hero in America and in New York totally changed. It wasn't the ball players. It wasn't Hollywood stars. It was ordinary people doing what they're supposed to do, even unto the point of death, faithful to their duties. Everything changed. And I tell you this last thing. As I was standing there at Ground Zero, we're so helpless. We ended up, that woman, Dr. Katarina Malati, was there with me, an engineer. As we stood there helpless watching this whole incredible catastrophe, we said, "Let us say the rosary." And we began the rosary at Ground Zero. As we prayed the rosary, my eyes closed. I saw once again the people in that building feeling so secure, so safe, going to the water fountain, getting a cup of coffee at 9 in the morning, getting ready for work. And suddenly coming into that secure place was this incredible, like an atom bomb, a plane coming in with 50,000 gallons of gas and exploding. And no place to go, no place to hide for those people. And something happened. I no longer saw them with my eyes closed. I saw a womb. And in the womb, I saw an unborn child. I saw an unborn child so secure, so safe, so serene, so happy. And suddenly I saw coming from outside the womb the instruments of the terrorists, the instruments of people who are going to take that kid and tear it apart and destroy it and have nowhere to go, no place to go, nowhere to hide. And then I began to realize, my God, Ground zero is ongoing. Ground zero is wherever innocent blood is being shed. Ground zero requires ordinary people to do ordinary things, to be the rescuers of the innocent, to let them be free and to live and to be born. And so you are called today not to go to New York City. Stay here in Seattle and go to Ground Zero, the place where innocent blood is being shed, which is not that far from where any one of you live. Be a rescuer. And that's what God wants. Those firemen showed an example, and we must imitate. You are called with Father Ed to go to these places and give this witness from, and you say, let God take over. Do ordinary things and we'll have extraordinary results. And I pray that you'll have the courage and the wisdom to do so. Thank you very much.